When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 102 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is Jessica Chastain, the 39-year-old actress who is best known for her work in the films The Help, The Debt, Take Shelter, Coriolanus, The Tree of Life, Lawless, Zero Dark Thirty, Mama, The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, Miss Julie, A Most Violent Year, Interstellar, The Martian, Crimson Peak, and now Miss Sloan, John Madden's new film about the gun lobby and one particular gun lobbyist, played by Chastain, who starts on one side of the issue and ends up on the other. Over the course of our conversation, Chastain and I talk about her journey from humble beginnings to Juilliard, as well as her big break, being discovered by Al Pacino. We delve into her breakthrough year in film, 2011, within which she appeared in six films, two of which received Best Picture Oscar nominations, and one of which brought her a Best Supporting Actress Oscar nomination. We also delve into her big follow-up to that year in Kathryn Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty, another eventual Best Picture Oscar nominee, for which she received a Best Actress Oscar nomination for portraying the woman who led the hunt for Osama bin Laden. Chastain reveals new information about the extent of her interactions with that woman, as well as what she regards as a coordinated attack against the film during the Oscar season in which it was in competition. We, of course, also talk about the many and varied films that she's done since, and her personal quest to highlight the stories of strong and complex women, like the one she plays in Miss Sloan, going forward, in part through her new all-female production company, which she says will take up a larger portion of her attention in the coming years. And there's much more on top of that, so without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
All right, Jessica, thank you so much for doing this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
To begin with, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living, or do they do?
Yeah, I grew up in Northern California, and my mom is a vegan chef. My father's a fireman in San Francisco. So we're very kind of not Hollywood at all.
Yes, and I believe I recall that your grandmother's been a big part of your life as well.
Yeah, my grandmother, she took me to my first play when I was 7 years old, and when I went to Juilliard, she moved me to school. She flew on the plane and helped me unpack my dorm room. But I first moved to Los Angeles. After school, she and I shared an apartment. We're roommates.
That's awesome. Well, speaking of just sort of childhood interests, and particularly with regard to entertainment, were movies a big part of your childhood and TV and theater and all that stuff? Or when did that enter the picture?
it had always been a huge part of my childhood. I was always watching as many movies as I could. When I had a birthday, I remember my grandfather would always take me to the movies. It was such a treat to go. We didn't have a lot of money, so going to the movies was like an event for us, and maybe that made it more precious to me. But I always watched television, and I still haven't gotten sick of it. Yeah. I love movies and TV, man.
Right. So as I understand it, you're a pretty quiet kid. And then what happened where, I think, again, with your grandmother, it was like some sort of literally a turning point, right, that you can point to, that you can remember, where your ideas of what you could be maybe changed?
Yeah. I mean, when I was seven, she did take me to a play, and she said to me, you know, this is a professional play, so it means that they're actors and it's their job. And I didn't really understand what that meant, per se. I was like, okay, it's their job. And then we went into the theater and the lights came up and there was a little girl on stage and she was reading, she was like the narrator. And it immediately started and I was like, this is my job. It never became a question of, what am I going to do when I grow up, or when I grow up, I want to be an actor. It was just like, ah, oh, this is what I am.
This is what I am, yeah. How did it evolve from that sort of awakening point to years later auditioning from Juilliard? What happened in the interim that was not only sort of an interest or a discovery or whatever, but you were actually putting it into practice?
I went to public school, so it was an interesting thing because I knew I wanted to be an actor, but you were only in the plays if you got good grades, and I didn't get good grades because I really hated school.
Yeah.
So that wasn't happening, and it wasn't until it was junior high that, you know, I signed up for the drama elective, and then that drama teacher put me as like the ugly duckling in the play, the ugly duckling. And, you know, we did these monologues for this, I think it was the end of my seventh grade year, we did monologues for Northern California District. It was like the state championships, mm-hmm, or something, and I won. And it was really, at that point, it was when I started to think, like, okay, you know, this is something I've always wanted to do, but now I'm starting to have other people acknowledge what, you know, my
dream. You remember
dream.
What that monologue was?
It was called, it was terrible. It was like in the Sacramento Bee, I think, and it was a column called, Please God, I'm Only 17. And it was written in like as a person who got into a car, a 17-year-old who got into a car accident, and they're rising above their body. And they're realizing that their whole life is over, and now they're... And so my drama teacher had pulled the column and said, why don't you do this as a monologue? And so I was up there on that stage crying my eyes out and saying, please God, I'm only 17. Right. You know, it was very dramatic.
And you could always tap into your emotions like that, though, even back then?
Even back then.
And Shakespeare was also, I mean, it seems like you said you weren't that into school, but it doesn't mean you weren't academically curious. Most kids aren't super into Shakespeare.
Yeah. I went, you know, there's this thing called the Oregon Shakespeare Festival in Ashland, Oregon. And we went, I think I was a freshman in high school, I think the first time I went. And I saw Marco Baricelli, I still remember his name, play Richard III. And it was the first time I'd ever seen Shakespeare. And it was so incredible because he was playing this villain, but yet he was so seductive in the role. And the language was so heightened. So I could understand a little bit, but I could, you know, it was this... I just was always leaning on the edge of my seat watching the play unfold. And from that moment on, I just started reading Shakespeare. My grandmother had in her house, you know, you buy like books that you don't really read.
Yeah, the collected works or something.
Exactly,
yeah.
Like the really fancy looking old books.
Right.
And so she had one that was the collected works of William Shakespeare. I have no idea what edition or, you know,
that's
was
great.
It Arden or Yale or what, but it was just this simple cloth-bound book, and I started carrying that around with me everywhere and reading his passages, and I became obsessed with that, so much so that, I mean, I really, really hated going to high school, mm-hmm, and I don't know what I thought I was going to do. I mean, my dream was to go to the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, mm-hmm, in Ashland, and I still have a keychain that my high school boyfriend gave me for Christmas that was engraved, looking forward to working with you here.
That's great.
And that was my big dream, was to work there.
So how, as you mentioned, maybe not coming from a lot of means and living on the West Coast and not necessarily having been exposed much to New York, it seems, how do you even begin to think that Juilliard is a place where you should be looking to go for a BFA?
Well, it's, you know, my senior year, there was a class trip through the drama department of around New Year's Eve. They were going to New York. And I remember I didn't really have any money, and then, because I was a high school kid, and my dad was dropping me off at school that morning. And I just said, like, can I have $500 for the down payment and I'll pay you back, because it was the deadline. And he wrote that check.
Wow.
It just kind of like, and he didn't have time to talk about it with my mom. And so it was very controversial. But that trip to New York, I think it changed a lot in me, because it was the first time I did visit Juilliard. You know, it was just one of the stops in this New York trip. But I got to know the city. We went to plays. I went to the opera and I went to Juilliard, and I still at that point didn't think that it was an option for me. I thought everyone was so much more above me that could get into that school, but it really started to expand my horizon, that trip.
So you eventually auditioned, you get in, I guess you auditioned out west, right? That
was... Yeah, I did Romeo and Juliet at Theater Works, which is a Equity House. I was very excited to play Juliet this theater, and the guy playing Romeo was going to Juilliard after. And I was thinking, well, if he goes, probably I could go.
Right,
why
right,
can't I
right.
audition for this, and why wouldn't I get in? And so I auditioned for the school in San Francisco, and I got in.
And wasn't there some Robin Williams element here as well?
Yes.
That was cool?
Well, the last 2 years of Juilliard, I got the Robin Williams scholarship, which paid for everything. It paid for books and my apartment and my tuition, and it really made a huge difference in my life and in the life of my family. I mean, everyone was struggling to keep me afloat in New York, including my grandmother, and people would be sending me they'd be sending me boxes of stuff, because in New York it's expensive to even buy like shampoo.
Yeah.
And it was so much cheaper in Northern California. So we were trying to do whatever we could to live off of as little money as you could.
Did you ever meet Robin?
I didn't.
Yeah.
No, it's so sad. I wrote him some letters my junior and senior year. And then I was in a restaurant a few years after I graduated. And I was telling someone the story and like about how Robin Williams changed my life. And it was a general meeting with a film director, I think, at like Fred Siegel or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
And 5 minutes after I tell this story, Robin Williams kind of like runs into the restaurant, sits down at a table and starts eating with these women. And the film director and I are like, oh my God. And he says, you have got to go talk to him. I said, yeah, I do. Because, I mean, it's crazy. I just finished that
totally.
Story and he walks in. But I said, you know, I don't want to bother him. I'm going to wait till he stops eating. And, you know, I always hear those stories.
Yeah, sure.
People approach. So before he finished eating, before the waiters came and cleared the plates, he jumped up and ran out of the restaurant. It was like he was just late for something
right,
and had
right.
10 minutes to come in and eat a few bites. And I jumped up from my seat and I was going to chase after him. And then I was like, no, I shouldn't do that. I'm too shy or whatever. And I don't want to tackle this actor to the ground. but now it's one point, you know, I always look back at my life, and that's definitely a regret I have, that I didn't chase after him, because, I mean, he was such a generous human being, and he definitely gave without needing to be mm-hmm. thanked. And that's just who he was, but
yeah.
everyone that I've talked to. But it would have been really special to know that I had been able to thank him in person.
Well, I think within his lifetime, you definitely acknowledged him in interviews and things.
So yeah.
I'm sure he may have gotten wind of that. But, when you know, those, I guess, 4 years at Juilliard, it seems like you really changed a lot and loved it. And I know that to this day, I've seen you, you know, tweet pictures or things of Lincoln Center. It means a lot to you. What kind of transformation happened there that prepared you for when you're then thrust out into the real world as someone who has to survive as an actor? What were the most valuable aspects of it?
It was interesting because I grew up in Northern California where we didn't have a foreign film theater. We didn't have like the orchestra was bankrupt, so we didn't, you know, the ballet would dance to a tape or like some kind of recording. And going to Juilliard, and Yo-Yo Ma would be in the elevator with me, or Isaac Perlman, or Brishnikov is in the cafeteria. It's just all of a sudden, you can't help but you're exposed to so much, not just in acting, but in all of the arts. They were constantly on this board that we had for the students to look at. There were free tickets, comp tickets to this off-Broadway show, and I was always signing up to go to the plays anytime I had free time. And then there was Lincoln Plaza Cinema, which...
The best!
And if I ever had a break, I would just go, okay, I've got about 2.5 hours, maybe I'm going to get lucky, and I'd run over there and say, okay, what's playing? Not having seen any trailers, no these actors or anything, and I just would walk in and just see something fresh for the first time, and that's actually how I saw The Piano Teacher.
And that was a big influence for you. A
huge influence for me, and in for Haneke and with Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah.
And I remember leaving that movie theater and going, okay, I don't know, something has changed in me in terms of what I understand acting to be. I can't articulate it right now, but I know that I've just witnessed something and I've learned something. And it was like that solid for 4 years.
That's great. So you come out, and actually before you graduate, you, I believe, were out in L.A. for another one of these sort of, it's funny, like the dipping the toe in New York before Juilliard, now you're dipping the toe in L.A. And this was pretty significant as well, because it at least gave you a little bit of a cushion as you entered the real world, right? What happened during this senior year thing in L.A.?
Yeah, well, the summer before senior year, I came out. My grandmother was working in Thousand Oaks, and I came out and I stayed with her for a little bit, and I took a couple meetings. And, you know, a lot of the meetings people I met with at network television or whatever, they were talking to me, and they said, why doesn't Juilliard come out here for a showcase? I never heard of showcases.
Yeah,
I
right.
didn't know it was such a thing. And they said, yeah, every other school comes out here except for Juilliard. So I went back to New York, and I talked to my classmates, and I said, you guys, we need to be going to L.A. for the showcase. Everyone else is doing it. And I wrote this letter, and everyone signed it. And we sent it into the drama department, and then I had a meeting with Kathy Hood, and she was like, we can't do it. It's too late. We don't have the money to it. This is things that need to be budgeted. And I don't know, maybe just it was the beginning of me starting to go, no. I said, Kathy, I don't accept that. I said, I know we can find a way, and we can work together. And so we went back to with the students, and we all ended up paying for our own airfare. And, you know, we created a situation where we did, in fact, have an LA showcase.
That's
and we were the first one.
That is great. And yeah. It really, in your case,
yeah.
did results, right?
It went really well. And it's funny because I'm about to work with Aaron Sorkin now.
Mm-hmm.
But at the LA showcase, I believe I met John Levin, who was casting he was like John Wells' casting director.
Yeah.
And I came in there into the, you know, they saw I did a scene from this play Tape. I don't know.
Yeah.
Which is pretty, you know, it's pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
And it's about rape and this woman who's a lawyer, and she kind of has this monologue where she eviscerates this guy. And then they said, okay, we want you to meet all the writers of the West Wing. So they flew me back to L.A., and I went into this room of like 20 people. I've recently told Aaron Sorkin the story.
Really?
He's like, really? Because he wasn't there. You know, it was like for some reason, he wasn't there that day. But I was in front of all the writers of the West Wing and John Wells, and I read that tape scene with the casting director,
wow.
And then they offered me a holding deal.
And that, for people, you know, who maybe don't know, can you explain what that meant, what that means, and what it meant to you over the next few years?
I mean, it was a big, big deal. So right after the showcase, I got offered this holding deal, which meant that I was going to get paid a chunk of money to only work for John Wells Productions for like 9 months. So it wasn't even that long of a commitment.
But,
you're right out of college.
Right.
You're like, great. So I was living in New York, and they would fly me back and forth to audition for stuff. And basically, you work off the money. So it's like a credit,
right?
They give you, no matter what, you're going to get that chunk of money, but then you kind of work for free until you pay off that credit.
Gotcha.
Within that 9 months. I was on ER. I shot a pilot for them.
That was your SAG card, right?
And that was my SAG card. And the end of 9 months, I still had a lot of money left over.
Yeah.
So I lived on that for a long time.
And then after that period, though, there was a bit of what most people deal with, right? Where it's sort of a little bit of a dry spell, right? Wasn't there a period where you were finding that it was, you know, you're a Juilliard trained actress and yet it's not getting you very far?
Yeah. Right? I remember there was one day when I came to LA and I had to reread for like the casting director's assistant. So I had to go through all these steps, it was for something like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or something really that I didn't think the character that I was auditioning for, because also it was a guest star that I didn't think required that much skill. Mm-hmm. But I remember having to come in and pre-read for the casting director's assistant, then go in for the casting director, then go into the producers. And it was a lot of stuff like that where...
How did it work out?
I didn't get that one. Which was fine.
After all that.
Yeah, it's fun. But that happened a lot. I read an article recently, like maybe a year ago, where a casting assistant wrote an article. She's now, I think, a casting director. Yeah. And she talked about working in New York, and she actually mentioned me. And she said she remembered when I would come in, I would have like 8 auditions that day. And I'd come in and she said like, I was a little like mess. I'd be a little sweaty and like I had no makeup on. And then I come in and I like do a really, really good job. And when I read this article, I couldn't help but thinking like, first of all, what an idiot I was to think like, oh, okay, I'll just go in and act. I don't really need to worry about my makeup.
Right.
Please don't show up sweaty. But then also too, I wish someone had told me that.
Told you that.
I wonder if it would have saved me many years of rejections.
Well, I don't know if you've seen La La Land yet, but even under the best of circumstances, when you come in there prepared and you're doing it right, it seems that kind of reminds non-actors that there's always like 20 people that look like you who are also killing themselves for the part. It's just demoralizing.
Yeah.
And they don't even show you necessarily respect a lot of the time when you're starting out at that in that point.
Yeah.
Right?
I would get 20 pages to audition with. I'd have so many scenes, it'd be 20 pages. I mean, I think everyone probably knows by now, I work hard,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time researching or working, and I always made sure I was memorized for any audition that I had from the moment I got out of school. No matter what it was, I was memorized. So I would memorize 20 pages and then show up for the audition the next day, and then they'd say, oh, we're just going to read the first scene.
It's disgusting.
Oh, it's just, yeah. Because also too, as a person, you don't know, are you saying that to me because you're running behind and you don't have time to audition this? Or are you saying it to me because the second you're looking at me, you don't think I'm right for the part? And you don't want to say that, like, never mind, you can go away.
But don't they get it? They get a photo or whatever beforehand?
Yeah, exactly.
They should not. It's just disrespectful.
No, I know. But that, it happens a lot, actually.
Yeah. So the point where that changed, though, was you're doing something off-Broadway, Playwrights Horizon,
yeah.
Right? And what happened there?
So I was doing a play, a Richard Nelson play called Rodney's Wife with David Strathairn. And, you know, it was just kind of, there was no money but it was fun. And I played David Strathairn's daughter who was in the 1960s, who was a lesbian and was secretly having an affair with his new wife. And he was some famous actor we were all in Italy. He was shooting like a spaghetti Western.
Later adapted for Cinemax or something.
So it was like this, you know, kitchen sink drama.
Right.
And I guess Marta Keller had seen it and she's good friends with Al Pacino. And he said, okay, I'm going to be doing Salome again. Is there anyone you recommend? And she says, well, there's this young girl who is doing theater right now that I think you would really like.
And that obviously worked out. So then what is the effect of, for somebody who was dealing with Buffy the Vampire crap, now all of a sudden you're in a play in LA with Al Pacino. That's got to bring in a different audience, right?
Well, completely. Right. But it's always a leap of faith because what happened is I got the audition. I was in at the Actors Studio in New York and I auditioned and it was this huge thing and I could tell, I was like, the audition's going great and I was so excited and I met with the producer later that day and he says, okay, definitely want you for this role. We don't know when we're going to do the role, so we just would like for you to hold this time. And earlier that day, I auditioned for, and I met David Mamet.
Wow.
On a television show that he was doing. And I really liked him and I really liked the meeting. And I had this situation where, and then they wanted me to test for the television show. But you know, when you test for TV, you have to sign a 7-year contract.
Before they even decide, right?
Yeah, before they decide if you get the part.
Right.
So that night I had to make this decision. Okay, am I going to wait and be available for Salome? And I said, you know what? Okay. So I didn't test on the Mammoth show. The play got pushed when we thought we were going to do it because Al took a movie and I thought, oh God, I've ruined my life. And then we ended up, we did end up doing the play. And I made no money, of course, in this show. And it was like a year commitment and I was prepping for this part. But it completely changed my life in the way of how I, basically Al Pacino was my acting teacher for a year. But also I got to see him go from theater to film, which has always been a scary transition for me to understand how the camera works.
Because coming out of Juilliard, did you imagine yourself... You saw yourself having both a stage and screen career, or you were imagining one or the other?
I mean, I hoped to have both a stage and screen career, but I thought it would be mostly theater.
Yeah.
I mean, my dream was to work at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
Right.
So I didn't imagine, you know, the trajectory that would... I mean, I sure as hell didn't imagine this, to be honest.
Right.
But... yeah, so I had Al teach, kind of, I got to observe him, and he was my director between theater and film, and then also the exposure that it gave me. We did Salome at the Wadsworth Theater in Los Angeles, and it's Al Pacino, who all these casting directors and all these film directors want to see.
Of course.
And then there's this unknown actress playing Salome.
Like, who the hell is this?
Yeah, why is she, how is she sharing the stage with Al Pacino?
Right.
and then after that, I started, all of a sudden, film auditions started pouring in.
Right, and Jolene, then a little bit of a break, and then, like, When It Rains, It Pours, right?
Yeah.
So let's just to remind people, because we had, I'm sure you talked about this to death when it was happening, but 2011, six movies came out in which you starred: Tree of Life, The Debt, Coriolanus, The Help, Take Shelter, Texas Killing Fields, like multiple in every festival, number one and number two films at the box office with The Help and The Debt in the same weekend. Nominated for supporting actress for The Help, which was also nominated, as was Tree of Life, for Best Picture. So all of that must have like hit like a train, or maybe not, because it actually, they weren't made like in that kind of a quick succession, right? It started with Malick.
Yeah, I did. So after I did Salome, we did the movie Salome at the same time. Then I did Jolene. Then I had about a year off, and then Tree of Life showed up on my doorstep in a way.
Because of Salome?
No, but I do know that Al and Terry had a conversation.
Okay.
It's always a scary thing casting an unknown as the lead in a film, because you're unproven, you know? It's easier if someone goes, oh yeah, I worked with them and they're great, or you have one film under your belt. And I remember my agent at the time was saying to me, because I was getting close on so many things, I was being told, it's either you, or it's between you and two other girls, or you and someone else, and it was always going to the other person. And I was so discouraged in that year, and then she said, you know what, something big is about to happen, because what's happening in your career right now is you're going to all these auditions, and you're always ending up, it's you or the other person. She said, it's the second one person takes a risk and cast you as the lead,
then the others will have the
guts. Everyone's going to jump in. And she was right. It's exactly what happened.
But with Malick, the another scary thing must be that even if you're the lead, you don't even know if you're actually going to be in the movie, right? He's always playing around with it till the end.
But that one I knew I was going
to
be.
Yeah, you had
to. Because when I got the script, I knew, I was like, okay, this is a very important part of his story.
Right.
And I was there. We shot for 4 months. I was there shooting every single day except for the last 2 weeks. So the only reason I wouldn't have been in the movie is if he only used the last 2 weeks.
Right, if he changed the whole movie. Right. So part of the interesting thing about those parts is that they're also different. And I believe chronologically, just to give one example, and maybe you can talk about how you approach such a quick transition, but to go from Take Shelter, which is sort of like, I believe, roughly the present day like disaster situation, to The Help, which is a period piece where you're playing a person who looks totally different.
Yeah.
What goes into that transition in a very short amount of time?
Well, that year I did so many movies back to back. So I did Coriolanus, where I'm like this English rose. Then I went straight from Coriolanus and did Texas Killing Fields in Louisiana, where I play this Texan beauty queen detective that's actually based on a real person that I studied a little bit. Uh-huh. From there I went to Take Shelter, which what you just described. Mm-hmm. And then I loved to go to The Help. And the transition for that character, because I didn't have a lot of time in between, is I just had to gain a lot of weight. I mean, if you look at, when I look at Take Shelter and The Help back to back, you can see the weight that I gained from one film to the next.
And you felt you had to do that because she was sort of buxom or whatever.
There was a sensuality that she had to her. And it was 1960, and it was, women weren't forced to be thin.
Right.
In 1960. Right. And like I said, I think it adds to the sensuality. I think the more voluptuous a woman is, the more sensual she appears to be.
She was kind of like a Marilyn type of. But of those six, would you have guessed that the one that I guess would be the most commercially successful and the one that would get the Oscar nomination recognition would be The Help? Was that clear when you were making it? Or because at the time, who was Tate Taylor? I mean, Viola was a great character actress, but nobody really. And Octavia, who I think, had you lived with her or something?
No, Octavia lived with Tate.
Oh, with Tate. So there was Ray.
But we all, it's interesting because I went and auditioned for this movie. My agent sent it to me initially thinking that I was going to want to audition for the lead character. And I was like, no, I really want to audition for Celia. And everyone's like, are you sure about this, Jazz? Because it wasn't my type
of
character that I would play. But I was like, no, I think I could do something with it. And I went and I bought a dress. I like dressed up as the character and I went in and auditioned. And the casting director told me this. I don't remember this, but I guess I had a Southern accent the whole time.
Of the whole time of the movie?
Of the audition. Like they thought I was from the South.
Really?
Which I wasn't going in there trying to be, but I guess I was just keeping the character.
Right.
And after we read the first scene, Octavia and I, because she was there at the reading, this was before she was cast actually. She just stopped and she looked at me and she goes, I love you. And I was like, I love you too. I mean, it was just so clear that we had a chemistry. And from the moment I laid eyes on her, I just loved her. And I think it was clear from everyone in the room that the team, her and I together, would be really special in the film. And I do feel like it was special.
Absolutely. When you're now suddenly going from being a respected but exclusively pretty much or mostly stage actress, done a few little movies, now you're like the it girl, right? That's what I think. That was what every article was entitled.
Like, no more, please don't.
Yeah,
call
don't
me.
Call you that. You're past that. Don't worry. But how did you respond to that? You're now, I mean, it seems from the outside suddenly a lot more well known. Mm-hmm. You were the fashion people couldn't get enough. That was a new kind of element of your life. A lot of people wanted to work with you that maybe didn't know about you before. What was that period in the aftermath where you now have to decide what you do with this? What was that like?
Well, in the beginning, it was amazing because I was just, I mean, the fact that Gary Oldman would come up to me on the red carpet and say, hey, my name's Gary Oldman. I like your work. You're like, what is happening in my life? So there was a few years of that.
Yeah.
And then I had a couple years ago, I had this strange moment where it feels like this job, you're eating cake, right? You're like, you've never had dessert before, and all of a sudden here someone goes, here you go, it's chocolate cake, and you get to eat as much as you want. But then you're like, okay, please someone, take a slice. Right. I'm ready to share this cake. So I've started to make a transition in my career where now I'm more interested in and excited and happy about creating platforms for other people. In The Zookeeper's Wife, Johan Heldenberg plays my husband, and I saw Broken Circle Breakdown.
Great. Yeah.
A movie he wrote. Yeah. I mean, it started as a play he wrote. He was acting in it, and he did this movie. He's a beautiful actor, and I just saw the movie, and he's amazing in this film, and that's what makes me so excited about this film is that people are going to watch it, and then they're going to call Johan to be in their movies. And also,
he's been chastened.
and Nikki Caro, who directed it, And so I'm more excited about that kind of thing now.
And that's what is Freckle Films? Yes.
Yeah.
That's a new entity, right?
Yeah, it is. It's about a year old. The Critics' Choice Awards.
Yes.
And I got the MVP award. I remember thinking, what am I going to talk about? Because usually when... First of all, you don't know you're winning an award ahead of time. So you're kind of not knowing if you're going to talk. So you don't really write a speech. But this, I knew I was going to speak. And also, I couldn't just talk about one film because it was a body of work. So I talked about diversity in the industry and creating opportunity for women and African-Americans and Asian-Americans and all of that. And how, I really have faith in us as a group. And I can see that when we come together, we can make something beautiful. After I made that speech, I got some crazy hate on Twitter from some probably crazy people that are going to vote a certain way this election, which I was shocked by. And then I was in London to promote Most Violent Year, and the journalists were talking, asking me about my speech, and then they said, well, now what are you going to do? Because, you know, if you're part of the industry, you're part of the problem. So I said, okay. And I created this production company, and I am buying material, and I'm hiring writers, and I'm going to act in some things, but I'm not going to act in everything. And for me, it's about creating platforms for other voices.
That's great. Was your first experience being directed by a woman in a film, Zero Dark Thirty?
No, I had worked with Amy Mann in Texas Killing Fields.
Oh, that's right. So, yeah. But with Catherine, who was coming off of just becoming the first woman to ever win the Best Director Oscar, her next project was this, and you get approached about, it was really like hush-hush, right? There was no details were leaking out about Zero Dark Thirty. And the whole thing, I got the sense for you, the real attraction was that this is a woman, Maya, who's not defined by anything except her work, right? I mean, we don't see, not that she doesn't have other aspects of her life, but she's not somebody's wife or girlfriend or whatever. And so for you to get approached by Kathryn Bigelow and to do that project with that specific part, what did that mean?
It was wonderful. I knew the responsibility of playing the role when I got the part, but also I hadn't read any of the dialogue until we were there in Jordan about ready to shoot. So Catherine had, I mean, of course I read it to myself.
Right. You know, oh, I see what you say.
But Catherine had never heard the words coming out of my mouth. Yeah. So there was also the pressure of that. What happens if I get there? And then she thinks, oh dear God, I made a mistake. And all of that. It felt like a huge responsibility to play that character, because even though I don't make documentaries, everything I'm in is work of fiction, but that subject matter needed to be very careful, and I knew I had to do as much research and be as authentic as I could.
Now, Mark, I guess, met Maya, but was that something that was availed, or was she availed to you?
I spoke to her on the phone.
Did.
Yeah. I don't think I was allowed to say that.
At the time,
I was afraid to say it,
yeah,
maybe
right,
when we're releasing.
Right.
But yeah, before we started shooting, I'd spoken to her.
And was it of any value, or was it more about just shading the character?
It was really helpful in creating the interior of the character. You know, I work both ways, because my characters actually look very different.
Right.
And usually when I'm working on the interior of the character, it affects the exterior, kind of helps me make decisions of how the character is supposed to look. When playing a real person, I much prefer to meet the real person and see what color nail polish they wear, how they do their hair, how much makeup are they wearing, what are they projecting to the world, because usually there's two different things.
Yeah.
It's who they really are,
right.
And then who they're showing. So it was, I kind of had to create this whole physical transformation for Maya on my own, because it was very important too that I not look like the real Maya.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Right. Well, so just to, again, stay for the record, people listening, another Oscar nomination that was back-to-back years? Yes, pretty nice. Number one and number two movie again with Zero Dark Thirty and Mama, but that one got sucked into a little bit of controversy. That's when we last sat down and did like a long form one of these. That was just happening, and so I wonder how you process all of that, where you think you're doing a movie that, you know, I don't know, did you anticipate any of that?
No. It's an interesting thing, this whole Oscar awards situation.
Yes.
And that was the first time I realized that, wow, it's almost like a political campaign. I mean, people hire strategists.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely think when Zero Dark Thirty came out, it immediately, as soon as people saw it, it like won New York Film Critics. It started winning everything.
Yeah.
And it was the film to beat. And I think some people set their sites, their target.
It was a target.
It was a target.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And the way, though, that where did they most effectively execute that? What was the, whether or not it was right what they were alleging, what was the most effective thing that was used against the movie, do you think?
Well, I think, and this is what actually really upset me, what upset me the most is how Kathryn Bigelow was treated. Because I remember someone at one point compared her to, who's the woman that had made those?
Not Lenny Riefenstahl, was
yeah.
it? Yeah.
Yeah. A journalist actually did that.
Jesus.
And I wanted to just murder everyone. I know. I just felt I was so protective of her. And
it was weird that she did not get a nomination that year.
It's crazy.
This coming off of a win suddenly for a movie that was so acclaimed.
Yeah, and she, I'm sorry. And she, you know, she was winning, like I said. Right. She won Best Director, New York Film Critics,
right.
NBR, like... And then all of a sudden, the media, I believe that there was a takedown. And
from another.
Yeah, and I think too, like as we can see every day when we go into the news, anything salacious, like people pick it up. And for someone to try to reinterpret her film and what she's made, because Zero Dark Thirty, it's a study on revenge. Mm-hmm. What happens to a person when your entire life becomes about death and revenge? And there are scenes where my character is ordering strikes and she's sitting on the phone laughing and her feet are up on the table. I mean, there's this detachment to that.
Right.
And I think the wonderful director that Catherine is, she has such a subtle hand and she doesn't ever want to make message movies. She never wants to hit anyone over the head with anything. She wants to pose questions and have you answer them. And I think because she didn't come out there and say either this is a pro this film
right.
or pro that film, it left it open to attack.
And maybe from both sides or
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So the last two things before Miss Sloan, and then we will hammer down on the exciting new stuff, but just your space movies, 2014 Interstellar, 2015 The Martian, you're working with Christopher Nolan and then Ridley Scott. These are massive movies, which you had said early on, I think, even the ones that were released by studios were not studio movies. So it took a while before you were thrust into this kind
yeah.
of big apparatus. Now it's happening. What were those experiences like, and maybe also compare and contrast the responses, because people felt passionately about both.
Yeah. For me, I'm very interested in films that create discussions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to lecture anybody. Even, you know, with Miss Sloan, I want to pose questions and have an audience show up and talk about it. And that's what I loved about Interstellar. I don't feel like it was serving a thesis up to you. It was forcing you to lean forward and think and look at your life and look at the idea of, are we the only ones here? I loved that it came out alongside Kip Thorne, who's a leading theoretical physicist, who was a producer on our film. He wrote a book called The Science of Interstellar, and it explained all the science
right.
and how Chris used it in the film. And I think it was interesting to have people say to me, oh yeah, but it wasn't realistic. And I said, but it was. That's what's great about it. There's poetry in science and in physics. And we sometimes think that it has to be black and white.
Is The Martian maybe just the more accessible version of Interstellar?
Yeah, I mean they're completely different
sure,
films,
sure.
absolutely. But I knew when I was making The Martian that it was definitely more accessible.
Yeah.
Except I will say there's a female commander of a space mission to Mars. So yes, the more acceptable film still shows, like, in the future.
It might be a little.
There's going to be some progress.
Hopefully it doesn't take that long, but yeah. And then you mentioned the MVP award, which was created, and you were the first recipient at the Critics' Choice. That was because the same year as Interstellar, we had The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, which was so unique, and I love that, where you're basically, I don't know how many people... Is it available for streaming now?
It's actually on Netflix.
Okay, both for... Because here's the key.
All three versions.
All three.
So I believe if anyone wants to go watch it, watch Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby, him, and then watch The Disappearance
That's
of Eleanor Rigby, her.
That's
my
did,
preferred
too.
Order.
And then them.
Don't watch them. Please just pretend it never
right.
happened.
But that was... It's such a... I think it's unprecedented, the whole approach to it. And then Miss Julie with Liv Ullmann was the third, and then... Most Violent Year with your old classmate, Oscar
yeah.
Isaac. And any thoughts on, collectively, that these three indies in one year with such different projects? I think all three of them are amazing, but what, anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, you never know when you're making a film, you never know when it's going to come out. You don't know what's it's going to come out alongside or what the environment's going to be when it happens. And I remember thinking that year, gosh, I wish I didn't have so many movies out at the same time. But it was exciting to have The Disappearance of Eleanor Rigby and Miss Julie and A Most Violent Year and have these really special independent films that were so completely different. Filmmakers that I absolutely
yeah.
adore and I think have a very promising future And we're going to hopefully see them for many, many years to come. And then, you know, also to have the behemoth of Interstellar.
Yeah, in 1 year.
Yeah, it was pretty great.
So Miss Sloan was made not that long ago, right? It's actually a quick turnaround, right? Yeah, it's amazing. And yeah.
It's another Zero Dark 30 moment, because I made Zero Dark 30 in the spring, and then it came out.
Came out in the same year. That's amazing. So just to kind of set the scene, and please correct me if you disagree with the framing of any of this, but basically a movie about the DC gun lobby and how a person who starts on one side of the issue winds up on the other, and but just a very passionate all-business person. And this is now coming out in a highly contentious election season in which guns are obviously, as has long been the case, at the center of very passionate debate. How did this one cross your radar, and what were the considerations before saying yes? Was that was the real-world climate a factor at all?
I first read the script. I knew John Madden was circling it, and I wanted to find another project with him because I loved working with him on The Debt.
Yes.
And then I started to read the script, and I thought, are you sure this is an Aaron Sorkin? Because it really felt like that kind of story in that kind of character and dialogue. And then I was fascinated by what I was learning about our political system and the ins and outs, but also most of all, I liked that it was a political thriller and that I didn't know what this character was going to do next. And I thought, how interesting to play that, because after you see the movie once, then you kind of go, oh yeah, and you can look back at scenes. But when playing the character, she's playing two games. She's playing her main game, right, her long game, and then she's playing the game she wants everyone to see. Or, you know, she's like, so she's hiding a lot of things, but she's always planning things out. Like, there's a scene where someone gets fired, and the scene right before, you can see her prepping for that scene.
So in retrospect.
Yeah, like when you watch the movie again, you know what's happening. Right. And there's all of that, and I knew that was going to be really fascinating to play as a character.
When a character is not, quote unquote, likable, is that, what's that like? I mean, she's obviously very ambitious, very focused on her career, very driven and ruthless. But at the same time, there are plenty of men that have played characters that fit that description, that is not something that is the focus of every piece about the film, as seems to be maybe the case here. So, you know, I just wonder, were you basing her on any real lobbyists? And also, what do you make of these, the way that we describe people like this?
Yeah, I didn't know anything about lobbyists, so I had to do a lot of research. And I read Jack Abramoff's book, and I thought, this is a good place to start. And I learned so much about the money in lobbying.
Right.
I assumed my character would wear no makeup and just be in the same clothes for 3 days. But then when I went to DC, I realized, oh, no. These women, they were very different than I had imagined. And we talked about everything. We talked about drug use in DC. We talked about personal lives. We talked about sexual harassment. Mm-hmm. We talked about less than 10% of lobbyists are women. What is that like to work in this town that's mostly men and you need things? And how do you navigate those waters? And then when we just had a Q&A a week ago, and one woman raised her hand.
This is in DC?
No, this was in London.
Oh, in London, okay.
One woman raised her hand and she says, I just want to thank you so much for playing a character like this. We never see women like this that are ambitious and, you know, capable and all of this. And then right afterwards, a man raised his hand and said, I'm sorry, I wasn't going to ask a question, but isn't she a psychopath?
That encapsulates that.
Yeah, and I've seen the difference between men and women. And then also you look at this current election, and after the very first debate, the criticism for Hillary Clinton was, she's overprepared. I've never heard in my life a person say that about a man in any job. He's overprepared. I'll just tell you right now, I am overprepared.
Right.
I want to be overprepared for anything I do. I see it as someone who has great respect for their job, and I really admire that in other people.
Well, they didn't like that she doesn't smile enough.
Exactly.
And, anyway, yeah.
But she smiles plenty. Let's see. She smiles plenty.
Yeah, right.
But I think what it is that society isn't used to seeing a woman be overprepared, be one step ahead, be ambitious, because those women that have been are the ones that are difficult, the ones that are the B words, you know?
Yeah.
And I think we need to, I'm hoping that this election and movies like Miss Sloan coming out will change our ideas of what a woman has to be.
And what have you got? I know the movie's still rolling out, but have you had much feedback yet from the general public? Is it the kind of thing where, obviously, it's such a divisive issue that it's dealing with? Do you find that you're getting, you know, pats on the back, or alternatively, you know, not pleasant things?
I haven't had anything crazy happen, thank God. And the funny thing is, I thought it was going to be more about the Second Amendment. People would be coming forward and talking about that. But all of our Q&As, no one brings up the gun issue, mm-hmm. the gun debate, which I find surprising. Mostly they bring up her, the character, and what she does and how she tricks people and the twists and turns in the films that they didn't see. And I've come to realize that the gun debate could be anything in this movie. It could be about climate change. Mm-hmm. It could be about immigration. It could be about anything, because that is an example for something else, and which she talks about at the end of the movie, about the political system being broken. And that was a huge surprise going into these Q&As.
So last thing is just this. When we did this 3 years ago, we ended it by saying, all right, what's the sort of state of Jessica Chastain right now? What's your outlook? What are you happy with? What would you like to do more of or less of or be different in the future? And so here we are, November 2016, the week before this election that we're talking about. And just what's the, you know, buy us the next 3 years. Hopefully it won't be that long before but what's your outlook?
Yeah. Well, the next 3 years, I hope I've got some of my projects up and running. I hope to introduce the world to some incredible artists. I'm probably going to act less. I'm feeling like my career is starting to transition into something else. I'm wondering maybe if I'm more interested in producing and maybe even directing. Yes, of course, I'll always act, but I have noticed I'm more interested in putting the spotlight on someone else. And maybe it's just because it's been a really exciting, intense 5 years. And I'm like, you know, it's okay. I'm happy to share this with other people. So maybe in the next 3 years, I'll be a huge Hollywood producer. I don't know.
Well, I look forward to seeing you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.